All right. I'm here with Chris Gimmer, co-founder and CEO at Snappa. And Chris, well, first of all, welcome to the show. And why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, I guess the long story is, I guess more of a traditional background in like finance and accounting. And then I was working in the federal government for several years, started to do some traveling and eventually just got to a point where I wasn't very fulfilled, wanted to have a bit more freedom in my life. And I really just started gravitating towards tech and online and what have you. And so I ended up meeting Mark, who's now my co-founder at Snappa in the government as well. And we became like pretty good friends. And then we just started launching a bunch of stuff on the side. And then eventually we were able to make enough money from one of our side projects to kind of take a leave of absence from work. And then eventually that led to Snappa. And so we've been full-time on that for several years now. And that's kind of the compressed version of how I got to where I am now.
It's fun because I've interviewed a few people on the Culture Builders podcast before, but I haven't had the opportunity to interview any friends. So I've known you for a couple of years now, and it's been pretty exciting to hear about the updates with Snappa. And I saw that you tweeted actually recently that you hit a pretty major milestone, and only a year after achieving another big milestone. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I was looking at our MRR graph, monthly recurring revenue. And last month we had crossed 100K, which is, you know, for a bootstrap company is a pretty decent milestone. We're pretty pumped about it. And then kind of when I looked at the graph a little closer, I realized that it took 35 months or just under 36 months to hit the first 50K of MRR. But then the second 50K only took 18 months. So basically it took half the amount of time to do the second 50K as it did for the first 50K. So it just kind of reinforces that like compounding nature of a lot of SaaS businesses and some of the marketing that we do with like content and SEO, where it can kind of start out a bit slow and you feel like you're not making as much progress as maybe some of the people that are a bit further ahead. But eventually that compounding kind of takes effect and then somewhat able to grow faster than you were like your first year or two that you're in business. So I just thought that was pretty cool. And remember, when you first started things, I mean, actually it still felt kind of fast at the time, but again, it's just like people have a tendency to always compare themselves to people that are like 5-10 years ahead of them. And I think not really realizing like that compounding effect makes such a big difference in like year 8, 9, and 10. So.
Can you tell us more about, I noticed that's something that you're really passionate about is the concept of compounding growth or compounding interest. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we live in a society where it's a lot about instant gratification. And it's really sad because a lot of the average person, I think, really puts themselves at a disadvantage because they're trading future gains for short-term satisfaction. But I think if more people adopted a low time preference and decided to invest, and not necessarily like investing their money or investing in stocks, but even investing their time into learning as opposed to just being on Facebook all day. And I think working out is also a good analogy. Like when people work out the first couple of weeks, usually you really don't see any difference whatsoever. But if you actually keep at it, the compounding effects of going to the gym 3 to 5 times a day per week, you kind of reach this like inflection point where you look at yourself in the mirror and you're like, holy crap, like I've like shredded. Whereas the first 2 weeks, you probably look at yourself and don't even see any change at all. So if you just kind of stick with it and do those little things day in and day out over long periods of time, you'll look back and just be so shocked about the progress you made. And so I've certainly experienced that in my life, both in terms of investing, entrepreneurship, fitness, really all aspects of life. Yeah, so it's just something that I try to preach is just adopting a low time preference, really thinking long term, and try to resist the temptation of that short term instant gratification.
It's funny because I actually had this as one of my notes I wanted to ask you about. And you are probably one of the most patient people that I know. And I actually noticed in your Twitter that you've got a line in your bio that says you're playing the long game. And I mean, like, how did you become patient? right? Were you always this way? Did you always have this low time preference?
No, I didn't actually. I was never one who would just like spend tons of money or whatever. Like I was always fairly responsible, but when I was younger, I wouldn't say that I had this like ultra low time preference and I was a super patient person. I think what I've realized is like the longer that I've kind of practiced this, the better results that I've seen. And thus I get even more convinced that this is kind of the way to go. And it's also like a self-reinforcing thing. So take investing, for example. As soon as you start investing and you see your money compounding, naturally you're going to want to save even more and invest even more of that money. And it's the same thing with business. It's like, as soon as you start putting in the time and then you start to see the fruits of that labor pay off a year or two later, you're even more motivated to keep doing that same thing and keeping up with that same mentality, and the same thing for fitness. So I would say that as the years have gone on and I've seen the fruits of my labor, it's made me even more incentivized to keep having this low time preference and keep thinking about the future, keep being patient, keep investing. So yeah.
Yeah, there's a good quote. It's like what people typically tend to overestimate what they can achieve in a month, but underestimate what they can achieve in a year, right? And I think even that's just a year, but like you're saying, if you've got a time horizon that's 10 years, 30 years plus, you can really achieve a lot.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think one of my goals has always just been like every single day, just try to do at least one task that is potential to move the business at some point in the future. And I think if you just keep doing that every day for 365 days a year and multiple years, I think what Rob Walling is one of the guys I look up to. He's built and sold several SaaS companies, and he has this concept called like relentless execution. And it's essentially just like every day, not necessarily like working your ass off or working, putting in tons of hours, but it's just like every day, just doing one or two things that it's going to move the needle and just keep doing that day in and day out.
Interesting. Rob Walling. Okay. Cool. We'll share a link in the podcast.
He runs MicroConf, and he also has Startups for the Rest of Us podcast. And he's super well known in like the bootstrapper community, and definitely learned a lot from him over the years.
I think one thing that people always find interesting about you and Snappa is how lean the team actually is, right? So in your post, you wrote that you're doing 100K a month. I think people might be quick to assume that you've got a team of 30, maybe 20, 30 plus people, right? But the reality is very different.
Yeah, I think for a lot of like VC-backed companies, they're obviously like always hiring ahead of their revenue. So yeah, like it's not uncommon at all to have 100K of MRR with like a 20, 30 person team. Whereas we're bootstrapped, so we've never raised any outside funding. So typically with a bootstrap company, you're usually hiring after the revenue is there, and then maybe even a bit more wiggle room on top of that just to make sure. So yeah, we're a team. So including my co-founder Mark and I, we're a team of seven. And so, yeah, we have five full-time employees right now.
And you guys were remote before it was cool, right? Or before it was the norm, right? What's that been like, seeing the world go remote now? It's probably weird, like considering you guys, you've been doing it since day one.
Yeah, we've been doing it since day one. I mean, I've always felt like for, especially like a tech company and all the tools that we have available, like Slack, and we're recording this on Zoom right now. I mean, there was definitely never any barriers to being able to work effectively online. And at one point, we actually had a shared office space for several months, and we abandoned that because we found that we were actually just way more productive at home, and the like in-person benefits just didn't justify like even going into like an office for a couple of days a week or anything. So yeah, it's something that I've always thought was kind of the way to go, at least for like a small team or what I know. Obviously, I've never run like a 1,000-person company, so I'm not going to comment on whether in that sense, like fully remote is better or worse. But I think for small teams, it definitely works great. I found we're more productive. I love being able to just go for a nice walk or working out in the middle of the day, just giving the flexibility to everyone. And I like to travel, so even being able to like work, I spent the summer in Florida, so even just changing up the locations and stuff. So yeah, it's interesting now because even pre-corona, every time I'd meet people and I'd tell them, yeah, I work remotely, it was still like a very bizarre concept, especially like here in Ottawa, where there's a lot of government workers and kind of people with quote unquote like normal jobs, whereas like we're not in like a tech hub or anything. Whereas like now it's funny because like everyone's working from home. It's no longer a strange thing. So yeah, it's been really interesting to see that transition from the rest of the world too.
And do you find there's anything that you do that you've realized over the years that have specifically helped your team communicate better while the team is distributed?
Yeah. So one of my biggest beliefs in terms of like leadership and running a company is just giving team members as much autonomy as possible. I've been in work environments where I've seen micromanagement, and I just think it's like the worst thing ever. And with a small team, you're able to be very selective upfront in terms of who you hire. So if you're hiring the right people, then naturally you should be trusting them and you should be giving them the autonomy to do their work. So for us, like running a remote organization has never felt difficult to us because we just work with really awesome people. And like obviously you have to provide the right amount of training and support upfront and on an ongoing basis. But at the end of the day, like if you're hiring the right people, they should be able to take things and run with it. We look for self-starters and people that have the skill sets. So that's been, for us, been really effective. Whereas if you're working in like a culture that has like micromanagement and incompetent people, working remotely is going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about being very selective when you're hiring too. What do you typically look for when you're hiring someone?
We essentially look for a combination of someone who is obviously like capable and has the right skill sets. And even more importantly, people that have the right character and who kind of fit within our culture. So our entire hiring process is kind of like designed to check those boxes. So in, I guess, the initial screening phase, we're really looking for like at a glance on paper, does this person seem capable? And is there anything in this initial application that kind of shows to us that they have ambition and they seem like a self-starter and that kind of stuff? And then in the actual like interview process, we're really looking for like, do they fit well within our culture? So like I said, we're looking for self-starters, obviously. And we also want an enjoyable workspace. So it's actually pretty important for us. Like, can we see ourselves like actually working this person? Would we actually want to work with this person? Do they seem pretty like happy and optimistic by default? And then, yeah, there's a bunch of other stuff. And then once we determine that like this person is would fit well within the culture, then we really kind of look at, okay, are they capable of actually doing the job? And that's where we'll usually give them a sample project. And lately what we've actually done is paid sample projects that are a bit longer. Because at the end of the day, like you never really know if someone's capable until they actually start doing the work. So we essentially try to like simulate what they'll be doing as closely as possible. So that gives us a really good indication of like if they could actually do the work. So yeah, it's a combination of like culture fit and if they have the right attitude and skill sets.
Yeah, it's interesting. And do you think like the culture has evolved over time, or do you think it's been relatively the same since you started Snappa?
I would say it's relatively same, but it has to involve or evolve a little bit, I guess you would say, but we're still such a small team where we haven't really had to evolve it that much. So in the beginning, it was really just being remote, hiring self-starters, autonomy, flexibility. So yeah, nothing's really changed in that part. I guess the only thing is going from 2 people to 4 people to 5 people, we just kind of evolved like how we're communicating with each other. Nothing groundbreaking, but that's, yeah, it's been more, I would say, like operationally as opposed to like the high level culture that we want to support at the company.
I heard this interesting concept. I don't know if you've ever thought about this or if you have an idea here, but people assigning a sort of character to their brand or to their culture, which often are the same. So if you think of Apple as an example, their character would be like Sherlock Holmes, right? They're very clean, very smart, very sharp, but kind of an asshole, right? Kind of arrogant. I've also heard of, I think of Hopier as an example, right? We're very fun, playful. You can think of us as, let's say, like Tweety Bird, right? So fun, playful, like very friendly. But the character flaw is that Hopier is not always, it's not exact, right? Like we don't care about being very exact. We'd rather move fast. And have you ever thought about Snappa as kind of a character before? Or?
That's interesting. No, I haven't thought about it in terms of like an actual character, but I would say we'd probably be someone who's pretty casual, I would say, and laid back, maybe some kind of cool character. We're not like overly fun and goofy, but at the same time, we're definitely not like serious or anything overly serious. So we're probably like somewhere in the middle, like just kind of a casual, calm type of character. Maybe like Matthew McConaughey or something. I don't know.
I know who's going to play you in the Snappa movie in 10 years now. McConaughey.
Oh, God, yeah. No, no, that he's got way way better voice than I do.
And Snappa wasn't your first company, right? Like you've started a few before and with Mark too, your co-founder. Mm-hmm. So what were those like and what was the learning experience of running those companies?
Yeah, I would hate to even call them companies. I would categorize them more as like projects or maybe startups. But so yeah, like I said, Mark and I, we met in the government. And to be honest, like our goal at that time was just to make enough money with our own business so that we can quit and do that full time. And so I'd be lying if I said that we were like really thinking about what's this like innovative stuff that we can start. So it was just like a couple like side projects. One of them was like student dating website, which, you know, got a bit of traction in our local cities, but we had no idea about like raising money. Obviously, we couldn't really monetize other than ads. So after a year, we ended up shutting it down. And that was kind of when I realized like we didn't know what the hell we were doing. So I started learning a lot about online marketing and how to actually run a business. And then the next thing that we started, which like actually got some traction and we made some money from it, was a marketplace for like Bootstrap themes and templates, similar to WordPress, but with the Bootstrap framework. And that's when I really started to kind of get good at content marketing and SEO and kind of learning those skills. And we built up that business to, I think we're doing like maybe $4,000 or $5,000 a month in profit. And that was when I decided to take a leave of absence to focus a bit more on that and try to continue like sharpening my skills. And then eventually started learning about like SaaS and recurring revenue. And that was really attracted to us. And while we were running Bootstrap Bay, I was kind of running into the issue of like designing graphics for blog posts was a huge pain. So one thing led to another. And then we ended up kind of moving on from that business and starting Snappa. So that was kind of the evolution of just messing around in the beginning, like throwing spaghetti in the wall, just trying to make enough money to quit. And then kind of eventually like learning about actually how to do marketing, learning about how to actually come up with like business ideas, how to do customer development, kind of how to iterate and test these ideas. And yeah, that eventually led to Snappa.
Amazing. And that was, how long ago was that when you started that first business?
So Classmate Catch was 2012. And then we kind of had like a 2-year period where we're just kind of spinning our wheels and not really knowing what we're doing. And then Bootstrap Bay, we launched in 2014. And then Snappa was the end of 2015. So depending on what starting date you want to look at, it was anywhere from like, I guess, 4 years or like 2 years if we're talking about like Bootstrap Bay.
Wow.
From when we first launched Snappa, yeah.
Okay. So one thing I wanted to ask you about, and today it is May 28th, Thursday, May 28th, 2020. And in the last couple of weeks, well, not even in the last couple of days, there's been a number of companies that have decided to go remote or fully remote. So you can say you're before Facebook, you're before Google, Shopify, et cetera, going remote first. But it was interesting because some of these companies, I know Facebook said that they will adjust the salaries or total compensation of people that decide to move depending on their location. And they are going to adopt a location-based or continue to keep their location-based compensation. And I thought that was interesting. And David Heinemeier Hansen, the creator of Ruby on Rails and founder and CEO at Basecamp, he was pretty critical of them. I know he's very critical of Facebook in general, but he was very critical and he's been very critical on this. And there's been a number of people debating this idea of whether you should adjust the compensation of people depending on where they are now that we're moving to kind of a remote work first world. And so what are your thoughts on this? Do you guys compensate people based on their location, or what do you think about this?
It's a very interesting debate. So to answer the direct question, so all of our employees right now are across Canada, and if we're talking Toronto or like Vancouver, there's definitely some high real estate prices or whatever, but apart from real estate, like cost of living tends to be fairly consistent, I guess. So we haven't done a cost of living type of formula or anything like that. I haven't fully like analyzed or looked at this too closely, so no one like please attack me, but my gut instinct tells me that it's something that is probably, I don't know how sustainable it is to do this like cost of living formula, because first of all, you need to define like what the cost of living is, right? Then you have situations where like if someone's living somewhere and then they're moving because their wife got a job somewhere else, and now all of a sudden like that person has to take like a bit pay cut just because they're moving cities. Like to me, it just seems very messy. So from the, I guess, the founder perspective, I would rather just pay what I think is fair for this job or market rate for this employment. And if someone wants to make the decision to live in either a high or low cost of living area, then that's kind of their choice. So on one hand, I don't think you should necessarily like punish people for living somewhere that has a lower cost of living. And on the flip side, I don't think maybe you shouldn't have to reward someone for choosing to live in like a super high cost of living. And this is if we're talking remote here. Now, if you're like running a startup in San Francisco, and you have to come into an office, like you kind of have to pay up a little bit because the cost of living is just so much higher. So that's kind of my overall thoughts is like, I just think in the long run, if it were me, I would rather just pay a set market rate. And if someone wants to live in a van down by the river and collect the difference, all the power to them.
And have you thought about hiring people outside of Canada before?
Right now, no, just because like we're a pretty small team. And so just like logistically speaking, it's just much easier for us. And every time that we've posted a job or asked for referrals or looked for people to hire, we've been successful in hiring really great people. If all of a sudden there's like a huge talent shortage in Canada, then maybe at that point we would consider going outside of that. But until we kind of reach that limit, which quite frankly, I don't think we ever will, there's not really like a need for us to hire outside of Canada.
Mm-hmm. And you said you go to, you're in Florida every year, right? You spend winters there. I know that you're afraid of the cold, although, you know, you are Canadian.
This was my first.
Cold. It's okay, Chris.
I am afraid of the cold, but this was my first winter. It was the first time I tried it. And I don't know how I can do another winter now that I've escaped it. So we'll see what happens this year with the lockdowns and travel restrictions. So we'll see.
So then are you, because I know that with a remote team, what is your policy around people like traveling and working? Is it similar to, it has some similarities to this idea of location-based compensation. Is it okay for people to travel and work from, let's say, Tokyo if they wanted to be in Tokyo 3 months of the year, or let's say they wanted to visit their parents in Winnipeg or something, or in some other city. Is that okay with you as a manager?
Yeah, 100%. I'm sure as hell not going to be the kind of founder that takes off for the winter and then tells everyone else that they can't. Like that would be brutal. So yeah, no, I encourage it, to be honest. Like I think that's one of by far the biggest perks of working remotely is, like, when I worked in the government and, you know, I had like 3 or 4 weeks of vacation, it was like, that was all I was looking forward to. And I think it's just a huge benefit to be able to, whether you call it a workcation or whatever, but just being able to switch up your location or your scenery without having to take a vacation. So one of our employees, actually, he has family in LA. And so he goes out there quite a bit, and usually he'll take like a week or two of actual vacation, let's call it. And then for another 2-3 weeks, like, he'll just work from there. And yeah, so we encourage it. I would say, like, the only exception would be, like, we have a customer support role. So obviously, like, time zones play a factor in there as well. But yeah, for the most part, we definitely have no issues with people working in other locations. Like, whether they're working from home, a coffee shop, as long as, like, the work's getting done and it's getting done to the level that we expect, to me, it makes no difference where they're actually sitting while they're doing the work.
And I know this has been an interesting, like, at Hopier, we've been 60% remote forever, and people have always had the ability to work remotely if they've wanted to. But I know people will always, that are kind of new to remote work, especially as managers that are struggling, they're going to ask, how do you know that they're working, right? And that's always, like, it blows my mind. But how do you think about that? How do you think about the question if people asking you? I'm sure you've gotten it before where people have been like, Chris, how do you know that people are actually working when they're at home, right? And not making sourdough bread or going to the beach or whatever.
Yeah. The easy answer is output. So let's take a developer. If they've been working for a week and there's no lines of code and there's no, basically nothing going on with the code base, you know that they're not working. Take a graphic designer. If there's no templates being created, if there's no SVGs or whatever, you know they haven't been working. On the marketing side, if there's no blog posts that have gone out, if there's no backlinks that have been created, if they're on the support side, if all of a sudden all the tickets aren't being answered, we know they're not working. Like, it's just, it's so easy, at least for us, to tell if someone's not working. And again, like, I go back to the initial hiring. If you're hiring people that you even have to question whether they're working or not, like, you've made a terrible mistake. Like, I've never once ever had to question whether our guys and girls are working. Never once, right? So that's kind of my answer on that is, like, A, it's really easy to tell. You just look at the output. And if there's no output to look at, then I almost question, like, you know, even if they're sitting in an office, you know, what are they actually doing? And then, yeah, I think just hiring the right people up front just kind of alleviates a lot of those issues to begin with.
Yeah, it always strikes me when people say that, because it's like, well, if you don't trust this person, should you even be hiring them in the first place, right? Do you think that scales? I've seen one example, Automatic, company that employs over 1,000 people remotely. And now, you know, it's the norm, but do you think that would scale, considering it sounds like the way to do this, even at scale, is just by having a good handle on what success means for that individual role, right? And how to measure it. Do you think that scales?
The answer is I don't know, because I've never run a 100,000 person organization. So I can sit here and give you my theories, but I don't like to pretend to know something that I don't. I think at the end of the day, really, like, once you get to 100 people or 1,000 people, obviously there's different levels of hierarchy. And then that kind of trickles down towards the organization. So obviously, like, the CEO is not going to know if every single 1,000 person is working and doing their job, but he'll have, or she'll have people reporting to them, and then those people will have people reporting to them. And then I think it's kind of at the manager level to really have the heartbeat on what their staff is doing, if the output is going. But again, like, I think at the end of the day, if you always default to output and what's being produced and the measurables, to me, I would think that it shouldn't matter if it's remote or not. As soon as you're measuring productivity by hours worked or hours or ass in the seat, that's where you're going to have some real issues. So my gut tells me as long as organizations are looking at output and measurables, then it probably shouldn't matter all that much.
And how do you find ramping people up when they join your team, especially as a remote first team? What's that? How do you make sure that goes as smooth as possible to get people up and running immediately?
That's a good question, and something that for each employee that we've added, we're trying to get better at it. So I think, like, again, it depends on the role. I think there's certain levels of process or documentation that I think is helpful. We don't want it to be to the point where, like, people are just nothing but following checklists and what have you. And then also just making sure that the training up front is really well done. So typically what we'll do is, let's take like a customer success role that we have or what have you. We'll kind of walk through like some documentation that we've prepared on like, here's 90% of probably what you would need to know. Go through this, read this over. And then the first week, let's say, we'll probably do some type of like shadowing, essentially. So whoever was doing that role before would basically like go through with the new hire on like video chat, let's say, and saying, okay, you know, here's this problem here. Here's how I would do it. And then that person kind of gets to know how it's being done. And then from there, what we'll do is like, okay, now you try to answer these 50 tickets or like answer them in a draft form, and then I'll go look over them. So then you kind of start to give them kind of let off the training wheels a little bit, let them kind of answer some stuff on their own, but you're still there to kind of look over things or whatever. And then eventually it's just like, okay, you're on your own. Like, let me know if you need help. Obviously, I'm always here for you. So it's kind of like a gradual approach. And then obviously leveraging like tools. So for example, like going back to the customer support role, we have a knowledge base. We use like Help Scout. So if there's something that they're unsure of, the first thing they can do is just like search for previous tickets. How have we answered previous tickets? They still don't know, then they can kind of ping whoever in Slack. So yeah, it's for us, it's trying to give them that proper training up front, having some sort of a shadow period where they can kind of see how it's done and kind of start to give them that autonomy while still being there to answer questions and what have you. That's typically kind of what we would do to get someone up to speed. And then one thing I'm actually trying to put together now is some sort of like an employee kind of handbook that goes a bit more beyond just the actual job or role itself and more about like how we communicate, what are kind of, I guess, more like our culture kind of written down, I would say, kind of how we operate. Whereas we've usually just done that over video chat, like here's kind of how we operate, but kind of getting that more in writing, which I think is probably a bit more scalable and maybe more helpful for newer hires.
Well, Chris, it's been great having you on the Culture Builders podcast. Is there a way that our listeners can keep up to date and follow you and keep up to date on the journey that you have?
Yeah, they can follow me on Twitter. My handle is cgimmer. And I started blogging a little bit. I have just a couple posts up now, but if anyone wants to check them out, it's chrisgimmer.com. And there's a newsletter sign up there. I'm just emailing when new posts are going out, nothing crazy. But yeah, those are probably the best ways that they can keep in touch and follow me.
Great. Thanks, Chris. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.